The winter is waning.
Well, unless you're back east.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just like it when the days get longer.
Yeah, I do too. Okay. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the February 17th, 2015 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. This morning, we're going to be taking testimony on a couple of cougar bills. I understand that there may be additional legislation that comes to the Assembly this year. If people have comments on prospective legislation, we will invite that as well. This has traditionally been an emotional subject, and people feel very deeply about this. I have the greatest expectations that in every instance, everyone who appears before us today will be appearing as an Oregonian. And I expect that we will always remember that some of our neighbors think differently than we do, but we have the greatest respect for them, and that as a state, we care and take care of each other. I'd like to take a moment and talk about some of the expectations that we as committee members may have, and what we would like to hear from those of you who testify in terms of what will help us make up our minds on the issues of hunting cougars. I'll go first, followed by my co-chairs and then the other committee members if anyone has anything. In terms of the advocacy that we hear today, I would like to hear how your advocacy is sustainable, that it considers the three components of sustainability, the economic, social, and environmental factors. It's like a three-legged stool, and if we short any one of those legs, the stool tips over. I don't want to see that stool tip over. So I would like to see how it sustains our communities economically, and that may be a de minimis factor in this instance. I want to hear how it sustains social communities, both human and natural. And lastly, I want to know how it is sustainable in terms of all facets of the environment. Number two, the testimony that will convince me the greatest will be scientifically based, as opposed to the everybody knows type testimony. Well, everybody knows that the world is flat. Secondly, emotional testimony oftentimes tends to shut me down. So just telling you what I'm about. Thirdly and finally, I will be looking for testimony that suggests to all of us that you're trying to solve a problem, you're trying to find middle ground, and you're trying to bring everybody together on this issue. If you accomplish that, you will be very persuasive in terms of what I'm hearing. I'd like to call now on Vice Chair Krieger for any of his expectations.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You really have, I think, summarized quite well the things that we're looking for. And I want to go back to the kind of the first point that you made, respect the opinions of others. This issue is emotional. I've been around it for 50 years plus, and I'm looking for substantive information that will help me make a determination of right or wrong about the policies that we're using now. I'd like to see information brought forward about the difference between our rural communities and large metro areas. We're different. Our habitats that those wildlife uses in those areas is different. I am not interested in emotionalism, because you can't manage natural resources by emotions. If I did that on my tree farm, I'd never cut a tree down, because I plant them there like kids. And I want to understand, which I do, but I hope it comes out, is the effect of management on the wildlife resources. And as the chair said, the economic, social, parts of that. I think that's it.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
My expectations are pretty neutral. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian, and as far as I can see, what we have in front of us is to try and make sure that the state of Oregon has a very good management position and management system for managing wildlife in the state of Oregon. And even though I think it's important for us to understand the differences between rural and the urban areas, as our other vice chair has stated, I think it's also important for us to remember that we're trying to take care of all parts of the state. And so whatever we have in front of us, we should be looking again for what is the issue and what is the solution that's going to be fair, equitable, and safe. And so I'm here to hear you.
Thank you very much. Go right down the line here for any committee members that have anything additional to add in terms of expectations. Representative Barreto, anything?
No, actually, I think everything has been said fairly well. I think this is a management tool to be used by the state for the management of our wildlife. And so when you take one species, you know, and it's been let go, then it affects all the others, and likewise. So when there are species that can't be managed that affect the others, then the state is at a disadvantage.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I think you've done a wonderful job of teeing this topic up for us today, and I think you've set expectations that are just perfectly in line with what I would expect out of this committee and out of these witnesses. So I'll hold my comments until we're finished.
Thank you so much. Thank Representative you. Esquivel.
No, I really don't have anything to add. Other than the fact, this is just a tool, and a tool is what we use and we put on our toolbox, the availability of having the option. And we do now in the state. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife do have the ability to go in, and they have to harvest so many out of a certain area. Example, the Heppner unit. They had to take some out of the Heppner unit, but they had to pay someone. So anyway, this may give us a tool in order for us as a state to manage this cougar. And I'll tell you something about a cougar. It's part of the chain. It's part of the ecosystem. And it's something that we should revere and hold very dearly, but it's something that no matter what we have, whether it be elk, deer, cougar, bear, overpopulation is not good. So therefore, it must be controlled, in my opinion.
Thank you very much. Representative Frederick.
Well, thank you, Chair. I have a number of concerns, and I will be, I've been looking at this quite a bit because it's something that concerns me. I would like to have the scientific information. I'd like to know if we have the information about how many cougars we actually have out there, not an estimate based on figures that are questionable. I'd like to know that. I'd also like to make sure that we are dealing with the tools that we have in hand at this point. If we have management tools that are already in place, additional efforts, they need to be justified, in my view. So those are some of the questions that I have. And I also have a very simple concept in terms of safety. I'm out in the woods as well. I know folks who are living in places that deal with cougars. I want to know how we are, in fact, making sure that people are safe out there, not just people, but pets and farm and ranch animals. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. I'm just here to listen. I think everything's been said already. It expresses my feelings.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
I feel the same way, and I'm ready to listen.
All right. With that, we're going to begin taking testimony just in terms of the audience. We begin with those who have proposed the bill. It's their obligation, presumably, to justify the need for the bill. And so that's where we will start. We're going to have a presentation first, a panel, of those who have proposed this legislation, followed by then a second panel, experts, presumably, who will be testifying in favor of the bill. The third panel, an expert panel, testifying, presumably, in opposition. And then we will open it up for general public testimony. With that, I'd like to call up first, please, Representative Springer, Representative Krieger, and Stan Steele. Good morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee. Representative Springer, I think this may be your first appearance this year.
This year, yes.
Yes. Welcome.
And I'm excited to be here, frankly. Well, thank you for having us here today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17. I represent 11 little cities, and my metropolis, if you will, is Lebanon. So we're very rural, we're very small. So a couple things that I'd like to point out is you have, what, three bills, I think, before you dealing with this topic, and very likely, and I want to thank Vice Chair McClain for being a chief co-sponsor on another House bill, House Bill 3000, that is very similar legislation, and any of you that have been in the building any time at all have seen two different versions of this bill that I have brought multiple times. So you're going to have people talk about the science. You're going to have people talk about lots of different elements. What I would like to do, and you have somebody that's going to talk about the bill, and certainly Representative Krieger has done a lot of work on this. What I'd like to do is offer to you just maybe a couple filters as we look at information today. So this session started off, believe it or not, less than a month ago. It's been a whirlwind. And from day one, I've heard two themes that I think are right themes for us to be looking at through this session: the urban-rural divide and equity. And those two things go together quite well, frankly. And as we look at that, I think back of the ballot measure that passed the ban hunting cougars and bears with hounds. And I think about where that passed. And we all know as a fact that passed primarily in urban areas. And in rural areas like mine, it desperately went down. And I think what that says to us is we have two ways of dealing with business in Oregon. And we have two cultures. That's not bad. That just needs to be acknowledged. And as we do that, we need to remember then that one size doesn't fit all. One size doesn't fit all. And so when you look at the three bills that you have before you, which I went through those, and I think they're identical, and then you have mine that you may be seeing soon, House Bill 3000, and you'll see that allows for that urban-rural divide and respects both sides of that issue. It respects the need that some have in certain areas to not have this activity in their areas, and that's fine. I respect that. I would also ask that the need to deal with the issues that I have in my district in a very proactive, reasonable, measured way would also be respected.
Representative, please pardon me. But I have made a gross oversight and neglected to open officially the hearing on House Bills 2050 and 2081. I have Representative Esquivel to thank for that major catch.
You're not going to make her start over.
Right? And I'm not going to make her start over again, but I am going to officially open a public hearing on House Bill 2050, 2181, and anything that folks want to comment on prospective legislation, we're in hearing. Thank you, Representative.
You just
My apologies.
Killed the role I was on. I will start with identifying myself for the record. State Representative Sherry Springer from House District 17. Do you want me to capture all of that?
No.
Good.
You're fine.
Good. So I want to go back to that urban-rural divide piece that I was talking about and allowing two different methods to solve an issue in the state of Oregon. The other piece is we look at that, and very briefly, we know that, and you'll hear this from the department later, that the last estimate I heard, and I know that there is fresh information on this from studies that have been done just recently and being concluded, and not all of the information is yet available. That's how new it is. But we know from past experiences and data that there are approximately one big game animal killed per week per cougar. So we're impacting another species. Now, that doesn't mean we eradicate cougars. That messes up the balance. What that does mean is that is a population to be managed. And I would offer this to you. We are seeing more and more sightings in urban areas, and certainly more and more in my area. And I got to tell you, on a personal note, I kind of chuckle and then kind of get my feathers in a ruffle a little bit when I watch the news and they talk about a cougar that's come in near school in Portland. I can't begin to tell you how many times I've had cougars at my bus stops and at my schools, and no news camera ever comes down and talks about it, and they say, you chose to live there. These are the same people that have been living in the same area for 100 years and haven't been seeing cougars. So we have the same problem. We're just dealing with it and see it in a different light in those two areas. And I would suggest to you, as that big game population comes down, I wonder if that's why the cougars are coming down even more. And I think that that issue we're going to see exacerbated greatly in the near future. One last brief point. As we talk about the rural and urban divide, and as we've talked about equity and valuing people for different reasons, good reasons in this state, as we are reducing that big game population and we are moving the cougars down closer to our towns, having more and more sightings, I have been able to, and I didn't this time, I've been able to bring person after person after person in the school transportation vehicle that actually hit a cougar with a kid on the regular route. We have those all the time. So we have that issue. But along with that, as we reduce that big game population, hunting is a very significant economic source in most all, actually in all but maybe one of my towns. And as we continue to decimate that, as we have other resources in our rural areas, we are once again creating great hardship financially, and that goes to our schools and all sorts of areas. So I just ask you, as we look through this issue, certainly we need to look at the science, certainly we need to look at the data, certainly we need to look at the anecdotal stories that people will bring before you. And I encourage you to look through those filters, that we are one Oregon, but we do business in a couple different ways, and it's okay, and both ways need to be respected. I thank you so much, and if you do have questions, I'll answer them. And I know that these guys are experts on this.
Thank you so very much, Representative Springer. Appreciate those comments. Committee members, I'd like to get through the panel before we ask questions, if possible.
Chair, Whit, committee members, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. Representative Springer's testimony covered an awful lot of what I was going to talk about, but I'll just get into a couple things. And basically, all wildlife needs to be managed, and we need to have all the tools in the toolbox to do that management. We do not have that now with cougars. We're learning. We've talked about it in this committee over the last two or three biennium. We're starting to understand the effect of all predators. Cormorants, we talked about in this committee, 50% of our downstream smolts. The last study here about three, 4 weeks ago, 50% of the returning spring Chinook in the Columbia River are taken by pinnipeds. Earlier, it was 75% of the fawn antelope were killed within 2 to 3 minutes of birth. And here again, this issue around cougars. When we have what I call excessive numbers, and remember, there are places, and there is a place out here in our wildlife habitat for predators. They're part of the system. It's whether or not, what is that number? Where is that level where you get beyond where they have too much impact on our resources? And that's what we have to try to understand what that is. On our ranch down in Curry County, I have a tree farm there. I don't go out now at all without having a sidearm on my hip. That was never that way years and years ago. But now the cougar are there, and it's September, was it September, October, I can't recall now, but one of the ladies was hunting on the ranch right next to her. It was my brother-in-law's place. She shot a, with a bow, a 130-pound male cougar. It was just a short distance from our property. And it reinforced in my mind that, hey, I need to make sure I am aware of that they're out there with us, you know, in these rural areas. And you've already heard that one size doesn't fit all. It is an issue more for our rural communities that have livestock and wildlife and private land that has these animals that we provide habitat for. And just in ending, I'll say that when you hunt these animals with dogs, rather than just in the field shooting one when you see it or if you call it in, you have much greater opportunity to take a look at that animal to see if it's a male or a female. And the hunter then can determine if he wants to harvest that animal or turn him loose. I just got back from the SCI convention in Las Vegas, and they were talking about, some of the guides there were talking about, way less than 50% of the cougars that they actually treat with dogs do they actually harvest. So it is an opportunity to have the hunt, tree the animal, and then if you decide you don't want to harvest it, you don't have to. But this has been a very divisive issue for a long time, very emotional. I think, though, that the main difference is that some people are directly affected by those animals being present. Others are not, and therefore they're not concerned.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean.
Good morning.
Vice Chair Krieger, committee members, my name is Stan Steele, representing the Oregon Outdoor Council. Also representing thousands and thousands of Oregonians who really can't make it here today. They're working. And so this is a divisive issue. It's a controversial issue, but it's an issue that has been becoming very regular before this committee and in this building. So obviously it's an issue that needs to have some direct attention. Whether you reside in Portland or Blue River or down at Gold Beach or up in Northeast Oregon, we're all concerned about the future of Oregon's wildlife. We all want to make sure we have the best management tools available to our managers. These are professional managers. These are people who daily walk the walk and talk the talk. Those professional managers not only have responsibilities to manage our wildlife for the benefit of that wildlife, but also for our society, and that includes a key aspect for the safety of that society. I've submitted to you today several different documents that will talk to you about public safety. Public safety is a key driver of this bill. Lions, cougars, puma, whatever we want to talk about them, whatever we want to call them, were some of the first legislative action that the territorial government of Oregon took part in 1849. It was a bill that was passed. It was called the Animal Bounty Bill of 1849. And what it demonstrates is history today does have a way of repeating itself. We were dealing with this issue when we first were recognized congressionally as a legislative body. 166 years later, we're talking about similar issues. Now, obviously, rural-urban divide didn't exist back then because sustenance through hunting and fishing was a part of everyday life, whether you lived in Portland or were a homesteader living in Gold Beach. The change that we feel has taken place is the disconnect. For people not to understand why certain laws or aspects of how we manage are different in other parts of the state. We have to respect the desires of one another and the safety. And then, once again, we've developed an agency that we feel can professionally manage our wildlife. We immensely restrict that agency's capabilities when we take away the most efficient tools of management. You'll hear testimony today, I'm sure, about the Mount Emily Cougar Research Project, an incredible long-duration project that used scent trailing dogs or hounds, however you want to say, call them, to capture numerous mountain lions, cougars, puma, whatever you want to call them, in a research project to see what was going on with that ungulate carnivore interface. None of those lions were harmed during the chase nor during the tagging process. It is not an inhumane or a harmful method of training a lion or then using it for research. Every one of the lions that were caught during that project were unharmed. It's a history of a tool that is not inhumane and not harmful. And I think you'll hear that testimony by our scientists that are hopefully coming forth today. But I want to get back to the public safety issue. You're going to hear today that lions just don't attack people in Oregon. Well, that would be like saying that we're not going to improve our highway systems after we've noticed a traffic accident in an adjoining state because we don't have that same type of accident in Oregon. Well, in fact, we will have. This is a population dynamic. California has had, recently, within the last few months, September, where a lion attacked a toddler, drug him off into the brush, and had the parents not been very quick in response, it could have been more tragic than it was. I presented you today in the written testimony with numerous other incidents. January 30th, Alberta pipeline worker, working on a pipeline, setting up a pipe to be welded on. His back is to the forest. The next thing you know, he's attacked. And it's a severe attack. Are Alberta lions biologically different than Oregon lions? Is there a mechanism there that triggers attacks in other states, but yet not in Oregon? Well, to some degree, there is. And that mechanism has been that we've tried to actively manage our lion populations. But the management tools that we've used in the past are no longer providing us the safety net that we currently need. You'll see lions in Roseburg. You'll see lions in Cornelius. You'll see lions in Sile. You'll see lions actually being habituated throughout the state. And that's the lion that should cause us concern. When he loses, or she loses, her ability to be concerned or fearful of human interaction, we can very easily become prey. I, as a public safety officer for my 25-year career, could not even imagine working a case, going up to a parent, and saying that their child was killed by an animal that we have the ability professionally manage using our best available tools. So in closing, I want to thank you for hearing what I think is one of the most important bills before this committee this session. It affects every single Oregonian. It's an emotional issue, but as Representative Springer said so well, and Chair Witt when he opened the hearing, let's work on fact. Science can tell us these are available tools. They're humanely effective, and we should make sure that everyone on this panel and in the other chamber considers what's best for Oregon and best for Oregon wildlife and the safety of our population. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, each of you. Appreciate that, and appreciate your testimony. Committee members, focus questions, if you will, please, because we do have a timing element, and I'm not suggesting that you should limit your questioning, but please be focused if you have something. Committee members, anything for this panel? Representative Krieger, I have one, trying to arrive at factually based information on this. You mentioned the hunter decision that is possible at the time of potential harvest.
Yes.
I have received, and I suspect you and the rest of the committee have, massive amounts of email. And a common theme among some of the information that I've received is that increased harvest necessarily equates to increased cougar cub orphans. Would you care to address that?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. The fact is that the most productive way to hunt these animals is with dogs. There's other way, just setting stock or calling them is not very effective. And clear back from my enforcement days with the state police, and maybe you could talk about the total years that's represented here. It was not uncommon for the hunters to tree the animal and find out it was a female with cubs or a pregnant female, depending when the season was, because at one time they were a predator. You hunt them all year long. So it does give an opportunity for the hunter to look at that animal and determine whether or not they want to take it or not. And I think that is, when you take that tool away, you know, a lot of the hunt is the pursuit. It isn't always the harvest of the animal. I've known several people in Curry County when they had tags years ago with dogs, and back in the time, they might tree half a dozen cougars in a month and only take one. They just like to be out there. And they don't run that far. Cougars are pretty short-lunged. It isn't too long before they're up a tree, and the dogs are at the bottom, and they can make their determination whether they want to harvest that animal or not.
Thank you very much. Last call. Panel members, thank you so very much. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Brett Brownscombe, Ron Anglin, and David Williams. Good morning, gentlemen. Good
morning, Chair Witt. Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair McLean, for the record, Brett Brownscombe, Acting Interim Director with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I am not going to take much of any time this morning. I really wanted to be here, to introduce Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Director, who has, hopefully, a good amount of information that I know is on your minds as committee members related to the science and the management of cougars currently in Oregon. And I really wanted to be here. I'll take notes, and I want to be sure that we're getting you as an agency, that we're getting you as members of this body, the information that you want and need to analyze bills and make decisions.
Thank you.
So I'll defer to my right.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. We have a handout that is being passed around to you. It's an update on the briefing that we gave you last session, and then we've captured a short slideshow that I kind of updated from last session late yesterday, trying to capture some real high-level things that are a little bit in the handout, a little bit of it, some different information. Hopefully we get your questions answered. This is actually a subject that we could very easily, if you wanted, give us the full 2 hours, and we could bring you all sorts of information that I think you would find very, very useful. There's been lots of discussions about what is the cougar population in Oregon. Do we have an exact number? No, we don't. We do have a model that has been criticized in the past. It's like any model, it has its limitations. We've been working on, unsuccessfully up to this point in time, working on trying to get another model in place, and our contractor at the university doesn't quite have it finished yet. But we currently estimate that there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 animals in the state. That includes adults and young of the year. You'll hear numbers used on how many deer or elk are killed by cougars. A lot of it is based on a 6,000 animal figure, and that probably is an overestimate of the actual predation rates, because it's the adults that do the predating, not the young of the year. So that number of adults is probably more in the 4,000 range. So just keep that in mind when you're hearing some of those kind of numbers. When you look at how many cats are harvested in the state, whether it's by hunters or it's over damage complaints, you can look back in what the numbers were like in the early 90s, and that's when we still had the use of dogs. We only, at the peak of our dog hunting, we offered 580 tags for the whole state. Less than 50% of the state actually had cougar hunting in it. So it was a very, it was controlled hunts only. People had to apply for those tags. They did not draw them every year. We were very conservative in the amount of tags that we were offering at the time based on the cougar population we had, and we didn't have very many, much in the way of harvest. After the passage of Measure 18 in 1994, we saw the harvest drop off significantly. The price of the cougar tag was still $50. It was during, I believe, probably the 97 session that the price got lowered to $10, and we started seeing an uptick in cougar tag sales. And since then, we've seen our harvest go up. We've also seen our damage harvest go up. The total mortality on there, the difference between that is that it also includes road kills, animals that we find dead for whatever reason. So when you add that all in together, it gives a little over 500 cats a year in recent times that we're aware of that die out there on the landscape. Our damage complaints through time have declined, and we probably think that there's a couple of reasons for that. One is back in the 90s, our old complaint system did capture sightings as part of the complaints, even though sightings really didn't necessarily equate to a damage complaint. There was a lot of, be blunt, media hype associated with cougar back then that kind of stirred the pot. When I was in Klamath Falls, every time there was a cougar problem over in Medford and it was on TV, I just warned staff, for the next week, we're going to get inundated with calls on cougars. And we did. So since then, we've revamped our damage complaint system. We keep track of sightings, but it's more as an interest type thing. As a biologist, our folks want to know what's going on out on the landscape, and you can kind of put together sightings with known actual damage complaints where you've lost a pet or you've lost livestock, and you can create a pattern. And that allows us, and when we're working with them, Wildlife Services, a lot better opportunity to respond to individual problems. But certainly we see and continue to see a fair amount of problems or a fair amount of concern expressed across the landscape, and has been pointed out earlier, we're certainly seeing a lot of that associated with urban areas. Wanted to touch real briefly on the work that we've been doing with cats here in Oregon. We've been doing targeted cougar research since 1989 here, and it really is pretty remarkable. It's been a commitment by the department to maintain this research over a long period, and it really has given us an opportunity to collect a lot of information. In addition, as part of all of this, you know, the cats that we capture ourselves and get information on, we've got all the cats that are harvested by hunters are required to be checked in to the department so we can collect biological information off of that. Similarly, any damaged cat that's killed needs to come to the department. So since 1987, we've had our hands on over 8,000 cougars, and the population, as we showed you earlier, has continued to grow, and concerns that we're really suppressing or wiping the cat population out, I don't think really hold true, but we certainly have a lot of good biological information that we've been able to cover or collect. The studies have occurred in the South Cascades, Northeast Oregon, and just a highlight of some of the things that we've done. That's not completely up to date on the publications and the presentations that we've done at this point in time. We've looked at every aspect of cougar biology and cougar science in these studies, and really tried to answer questions that will help inform our commission in development of our management plans and overall management of cats. You heard about the Mount Emily study in Northeast Oregon, and the Wenaha Sled Springs is also kind of embedded in that. And just wanted to point out that, you know, some of the things that we found coming out of this. We had a total of 68 cats that we collared up there, and just less than 50% of those cats actually died over the 7 years. And you can see that of those that died, there was about 54% that hunters comprised the most of the mortality. And then the natural mortality could be from several different things, could be from disease, could be from accidents, could even be from cats killing each other. We know that in really dense situations that male cougars are highly territorial, and they will kill the other cats that invade their territory, whether it's their own offspring or it's cougars that are immigrating in from outside the area into their territory. Those males will actually kill them when they feel is appropriate. We also looked, as part of all of this, at elk calf survival in Northeast and how that was influenced or impacted by nutrition or by predation. We were seeing low calf survival, and the two things that you typically think of when you look at that is it's a habitat thing or something's killing. So we looked at both of those, and what we found was that nutrition in Northeast Oregon was not a problem. That we had adequate food on the ground for those elk to survive and to raise calves, but in fact that when it all rolls together, that cougar and predation were the primary cause of mortality on those elk calves that did die. So based on that, and I don't have a slide that really touches on it, but we do have it in the handout, we have implemented some cougar target areas in the state where we've gone in and manipulated the cougar population in one of two ways. One, either using dogs, or two, using traps, and we've removed cougars from the population within those management units. And we have seen some mixed results, but we have seen elk actually respond in a positive manner when we've reduced the cougar population. So we saw elk calf survival come back up, and we saw the population increase. How does that all tie together? You know, it's really related to cougar density across the landscape, and we have some rough densities that we've looked at and estimated, looking at habitat and prey availability. And what our research has shown that is, as the cougar population gets to higher levels, so in those really highly dense areas, you see lower calf survival. And that's reflected on this graph. There's one little blue dot down there. It's kind of the diamond in the rough, if you will, and that's just kind of an outlier. But when you look at when you pull that out and just look at the rest of the red dots, it shows you a pretty tight link between elk calf survival and cougar density. What we found in our research so far with the dogs is that there seems to be a little bit of a choice in cougar harvest on what their prey is. Male cougars are more apt to focus, you know, kind of 50-50 on deer and elk, whereas the females will focus primarily on deer. And you think about that, males tend to be bigger. Females, there's a lot of risk with taking on an elk. And females, typically, they'll have kittens. Kittens will stay with them for a year to a year and a half before they're kicked out. So there's a lot of risk there. The females tend to focus primarily on the deer. What we've seen is that females that have kittens with them will kill more frequently. And when it's hotter, we see all cougars kill more frequently because their prey or their spoil, everything will spoil. Males tend to be, about once every 8-9 days or so in the colder weather, and about once a week in the warmer weather. We've seen, we've looked at if we reduce the cougar population, do we see a response in deer? We haven't been able to pick that up yet. And I don't have a graph here to show it to you today, but part of our research in the Mount Emily showed that when it came to deer, that cougars were taking in equal proportions adults and fawns. So, you know, it was about a 50-50 split. And if you remove cougars from the population, then what you will see is a response in the deer population at that same 50-50 split. So it's been very difficult for us to measure what the change is in the population when we remove cats and in our research under those kind of situations. And we continue to look at that and see if we can sort that out. So in summary, you know, we've been working on cougars for a long time. We have documented that cats are impacting elk. It appears that cats are impacting deer. We just can't seem to be able to measure it at this point in time. We're still looking at ways to do that. And we are utilizing, as part of the cougar target areas, we are utilizing wildlife services through contracts to help us manipulate cougar populations. And in some units, we've been utilizing agents, which we're authorized to do. Agents typically would use dogs. And wildlife services would trap, and in some specialized cases, maybe use dogs, but primarily trap. So that concludes what I had, Chair Witt.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Mr. Anglin, thank you for being here, and thank you for your presentation. Could you go back to the slide that says nutrition predation study? I think that Representative Esquivel and I are scratching our heads a little bit. Could you
explain? I wanted to know what the point
explain,
4.5.
What's the survival axis? Could you explain that slide?
Oh, you're talking about this one?
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
I mean, what does that mean?
So what you see on this is that, as an example, if the cougar density down here on the bottom axis is around 2, then what you end up with at the end of the year is roughly a 50% survival estimate on your calves.
Oh, okay.
Calves
so, 100 cows?
Calves.
Right.
Okay.
Calves per 100 cows. So when you get out here to the far right, when you're around 3, that line is up there probably 42% calf survival. And when you get to the higher densities out there around 4, it drops down to even lower numbers.
Okay.
And what we estimate is, you know, if you want to see the population at least be stable, you need to have at least 32 to 35 calves per 100 cows. Just to maintain a population.
Follow up, Chair Witt?
Yes.
And the blue dot, once again?
That was an outlier in the data. And, you know, I apologize. I'm not going to be able to give you a real good answer on this because I found out I was doing this at about 5 o'clock last night.
Okay.
And I didn't have a chance to get a hold of our researcher on the phone. So I apologize.
Thank you so much for clarifying that. I just appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Williams, welcome to our committee. We're fortunate to be able to have our federal partners join us this morning. Thank you for your presence.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Williams. I'm the state director for the USDA APHIS Wildlife Services Program. And I'm not here to testify before or against the bills, just from our unique role in wildlife management, we can provide some insight into the magnitude and the complexities of wildlife conflict management, in particular cougars. We're not regulatory, we're not enforcement, we're a service agency. And managing wildlife conflicts is an integral part of wildlife management, and we do that along with funding from the state, ODA, ODF&W. The majority of our funding do come from counties. We have a core that creates our core program, and where we have full-time employees based in 26 counties. We work very, very closely with local ODF&W district bios in resolving conflicts. And counties, as I mentioned, invest very heavily in the program. They do so even though they have very, very big stresses on their budgets because they recognize the economic impacts of wildlife conflicts of all types and as well as the potential threats to human health and safety. And they want a response to those big issues for them. In the last, during the first 1.25 years of this biennium, we worked over 31,000 wildlife conflict tasks. And some conflicts take multiple tasks to go out and address. We have over 1,000 unique conflicts of, you know, could be birds and at vineyards, cougars with human health and safety, quite a diversity of things that we deal with. And they give you a perspective as far as, you know, what are cougars generating for our workload, if you will, and an indicator of what's going on with cougar conflicts. Over 2,400 work tasks associated with resolving cougar conflicts in the state, with 1,880 in livestock conflicts, 334 in human health and safety conflicts, or tasks or work projects associated with resolving those conflicts or assisting with those conflicts, and 71 involving pets. We also assist the state, as Ron had mentioned, with some of the administrative removals to help them with either their cougar target zones or their mule deer initiatives, and helping them meet their management objectives. When we work on projects, most of our work is responding to a conflict or damage. At that point in time, the statutes allow us to function as the agent for the landowners. We work as an agent under agreement with ODF&W. When it's human health and safety threats, we don't make that call. That's an ODF&W call, but often our folks are collaborating on that, because you might have a cougar that maybe one event, maybe just a sighting in someone's backyard, or a cougar killed a deer and buried it in someone's backyard or someone. Because we work closely with ODF&W biologists, we are keeping each other appraised of cougar activities in and around the area, and that gets to some of that the discussion that Ron mentioned earlier. Sometimes cougars get very habituated or comfortable living around humans, and we can provide the overall picture of what's going on with a particular cougar in the area. We, just like any good repairman, would like to have as many tools in our toolbox when we go out on the job, so that we're not trying to force a tool to fit the scenario, and rather than take the scenario and pick the ideal tool. And what I'm getting at is, we don't always go to cougars, cougar hounds, because not all of our folks have them. But additionally, the scenario might not fit that. We might be working in a residential area with multiple properties, and we can't turn dogs loose in that scenario. We might not want to put our dogs that are very valuable in jeopardy where there's busy highways nearby. So we'll use equipment. On average, in a given year, we might take maybe 60% of the cougars with hounds. Sometimes when we're in those years where we're working on administrative removal projects, one of those projects may be particularly suited for hounds, and that will skew our data more heavily towards the use of hounds. But again, we're interested in fortunate enough to have all the tools available to us in our toolbox, because Measure 18 provisions do allow us to utilize hounds in the official capacity of our job. With that information, I might stop discussing some of the things that we do, and perhaps some of the things that I've already mentioned might have picked some questions on your parts, and that's why I'm here to more provide the information you need than what I want to tell you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony from the panel members. Committee members, questions for anyone? Yes, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I want to go back to something you just finished talking about. It appears as though you have tools available. Why the need for this additional effort? You have the tools, as I understand it. I'm not sure how many tags have been put out for cougars in the state. As I understand it, it's thousands. It's how many thousands? Can you tell me? Because I had a figure that I couldn't believe. I was told 50,000. Is that accurate?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick. Yes, that is accurate. It's about 50,000. But the difference is that we only have about a 2 or 3% success rate with that number of tags as compared to the old days where we had 580 tags and a 30 to 40% success rate. So you really see this disparity because just wandering through the woods, your chance of seeing a cat is pretty slim. As compared to the more efficient tool of using dogs to track things down. So the question about the tools availability is, it's kind of like your car. Do you do preventative maintenance, or do you do work ahead of time, or you wait until something's broken? And in some cases, what Dave's dealing with and what we're dealing with is something's broken. And so we've got a problem. We've had a loss, from a livestock standpoint or a human safety standpoint. We're responding to that with the tools that we have available. So the question that I think the bills get at and the contemplation is, do you want to do any kind of preventative work, if you will, ahead of time and allow a better opportunity for management of a cougar population that might reduce some of the potential for something to break, if you will.
I guess I have to get back to this. It seems as though you already have the tools to be able to do that. And I guess I'm missing something here in terms of your explanation. It seems to me that you already have the ability you have sure. The ability to use dogs if you need to manage the system. Am I incorrect on that? You do have the ability to use dogs right now to manage this. So they're not being used, or no one wants to use them, or that and it doesn't appear as those dogs are necessarily in those urban areas where traffic might be a problem. I'm missing something here. If it's for safety, and I understand the safety. In fact, critically, I understand the safety, not just with cougars. I had, a bobcat walk across a schoolyard in Portland that created quite a bit of a problem, and I understand the safety issues. If it's safety, that's fine. Obviously, it's not food because cougars aren't that. Is it trophy? I'm trying to get a sense of why you need an additional effort regarding the dogs if you already have the ability to use the dogs to manage the system.
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, when you look at our units as a whole and where we have identified we have significant problems in maintaining deer or elk populations, you look at our research that indicates that cougar predation is a significant part of that. The use of the tools you're talking about, yes, they're there, but they're very expensive to use. We have to pay Wildlife Services to go in and remove cats if we want to remove cats in an area. Or if we use volunteer agents, we also reimburse them for their mileage, but there's a cost associated with that in going in and reducing a cat population, and we can't afford to do that across any kind of a broad landscape. So the discussion on the bill and whether the bill's good or not, we're not saying, is do you want to utilize hunters in a similar type manner that we currently are paying somebody else to do? So do you utilize hunters that are willing to pay to go out and do it versus hunters are paying us that we turn around and pay somebody else to go out and do some of the work in some of the units? So that's really, I think, kind of the breaking point or the difference between the two is, you know, for us to implement, if we were, the decision was made to do that, for us to implement cougar target areas and manage the cougar population where, to whatever number our commission felt was appropriate, would be cost prohibitive for us as an agency to do.
So let me get, well, let me make sure that I'm getting this. The cost of the tags is minimal. It was dropped. It increased a little bit. You have more than 50,000 tags out there. You have a target number that is now a 900, what is it, 900 cougars that you would like to have. I can't remember where I saw that. You have a target of now 900 cougars that you'd like to take. Is that correct? And you had for years you had 777 target range, and yet you were only able to get a small number of that, those by way of the tags. So you need to have hunters go and do this because the state cannot do it, or you have a real desire by hunters to do this, and you want to reinstate the dog hunting approach, even though it was denied or changed by way of the measure several in, was it 94? Mm-hmm. So that's am I getting that correct? Am I following this particular system?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, you're combining several different things. First off, this isn't our bill, so
right. I understand.
We're not pushing it. The second thing, the numbers you're talking about are the quotas that our commission establishes by management zone, that if we were to reach a quota in any management zone, biologically, what we're saying is we think we've harvested enough and we're going to shut the cougar hunting season down for that year. So it gives us a maximum harvest that would be allowed. We've only had one management zone where we've consistently hit that quota, but even when I say consistently, it's not every year.
Which zone was that?
So we've hit it, I think, two out of maybe 3 years in the last 15 years in far northeast.
The Wawa area?
Yes, and then we've hit it, which is kind of the Blue Mountain zone,
right. Blue Mountain.
And then we've hit it in the Columbia Basin coastal zone, I think twice out of the last 7 years. So it's only been in more recent time that we've actually hit the quota, and when we do, we shut the season down because we don't want to over-harvest. We've got models in place to prevent that. So really, what you're talking about is, again, you know, we just soon, if hunters can take the cats, that's the most efficient way to do it. It gives us the greatest flexibility to direct hunters where they go. We're bringing in income from that. It's the North American model of wildlife management. You know, the fact that we as an agency haven't been able to do that, and then the current cougar plan gives us the authority. The commission said you can go out and in areas where you deem appropriate, you can implement these target areas and administratively remove cats. We've done that. We've kind of rotated around. And what we found from our simulations and everything is within 3, maybe 5 years max after removing those cats, once we stop, the cat population has come back to the pre-removal areas or numbers. So you really, it really indicates from a management perspective that we're not keeping up with reproduction. And if we want to manage the population at some level, that we don't have all the tools that we're able to use available to us.
And one last question.
Yes.
Thank you. It also indicates for me that perhaps the management plan is not sustainable in the way that it should be. If you are, in fact, saying that you know now that if you leave for a couple of years, things continue to go back, we need to find some way to be effective in support of your team, ODF&W, in being able to do the management approach. I mean, to really go in and stay with it, not and stay with a particular area. I am concerned about a number of, within the Mid-Willamette Valley, the cougar population along the Coast Range, not Coast Range, but the Cascade foothills. That's a concern of mine, but we also need to make sure that we're doing it well and correctly. Now, I understand that dogs are the best way to do that, but you need to have the resources to be able to do that and do it well, because the concern that I'm hearing from my constituents, and I'm getting lots of letters. I'm sure we're all getting lots of letters.
Mailboxes
are full of emails and whatever on both sides of the issue. I mean, I'm getting an equal amount from both sides of the issue. In my particular district, I am getting emails from Nevada and Arizona and Arkansas and other places, which frankly doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But I'm also getting a lot of things from within my district. And within my district, the predominant group of folks, the messages I'm getting from within my district, are folks who are concerned that this is tied less to safety and more to trophy. And so I want to make sure that that people understand that's the message I'm getting from my constituents. And I've got to say this as well. My constituency is no longer a hunting constituency. When I moved into my house on my street, there were five people who hunted. The families would take off, or the men, often just the men, and their sons would take off and go hunting for food. They would bring back an elk, and that would be put in their freezer. That's no longer the case in my district. In fact, I don't think I have a single hunter on my street right now. So that they don't have that kind of connection, and or that desire, and that's the message that I'm getting from my constituency. A concern again that this is not a matter of safety; that this is more a matter of trophy. And until we can actually answer those kinds of questions, that it's going to be very difficult for me to understand why we need to take that next step. Thank you,
Representative McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Witt. I appreciate the good representative's comments, because this is the crux of, I believe, what Representative Springer opened this conversation with, which is that difference between the parts of our state who have a culture of hunting that's very, very deep-rooted and very well understood, and parts of the state who do not any longer have that deep sense of the sporting activities that a lot of us hold dear. And I think that characterizes what this conversation is about. I think you captured something I was going to get to as you were going through your response to Representative Frederick, and that is the cost to the agency of a system that you're going to manage one way or another. Which is we manage elk populations, we manage deer populations, we manage our wildlife. Cougar is one of many things we manage. And to manage populations, the tools that you use are important, And the crux of the point of what I wanted to get to as this unfolded, which you hit on very nicely, is you're going to keep the cougar population in a certain range, and we're either going to pay to have it done or people are going to pay us to have it done. Mm-hmm. And the cost to the system is one of a decision that we need to make. It's going to happen more than likely with dogs, and we're either going to hire folks or we're going to allow people to go hunt. And I think that's the root of part of what we're getting at here. And I thank you for articulating that well. I know this is going to unfold over time. We have a lot of people who want to testify, and we have a lot of other people who want to be heard, so I won't belabor this. But thank you for getting to the heart of, I think, a big piece of this. One other thing I want to note is the beauty of, I think, the legislation that is being proposed in the three bills is it allows those rural communities to put something on the ballot, and their citizens can decide if this is something that they're interested in doing. Then bring those management practices into place through the agencies that allow it to not be a financial drain on the system, but to be a boon to the system so that we can manage our populations better. So I'll leave it at that, Chair Witt.
Thank you. Representative Barreto and Representative Esquivel on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I had on the cougars and their, I think you were talking about the mortality rate, and some cougars are killed by other cougars, and the territorial aspect of it. When the populations grow like they are, and there's not enough room for them to spread around, it seems, or at least I've heard, that's when cats come down into urban areas. So could you just speak to that a little bit? And then I also heard that a big tom, and we have cougars in our area that get over 200 pounds, will chase even bears out of their territory. Is that true also?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, the dispersal of young cats out of where they were born, they're all, you know, once the female kicks them out, they're looking for a place to set up shop. And what you see, and what our research has shown, is that female cougar densities and territories can overlap quite a bit, and they seem to be a lot more tolerant of them. The males, not so much. And they're either actively or aggressively chased out of the dominant male territory, or they're killed. And what we've seen is there appears to be no pattern to that dispersal. They're just looking for available habitat and where they can set up shop. I think we've seen primarily that a lot of that dispersal and where those territories have set up have been in the foothills and then in more populated areas because we didn't have cougars there. They'd been dealt with either through damage complaints already or they were at lower densities. When I worked in Roseburg, we saw several hot spots of what I would call damage areas where I think it was primarily dispersing cats coming out of the Cascades down into the Myrtle Creek area and then into the Yoncalla area, which were natural kind of passageways coming down ridgelines out of the Cascades towards I-5. You do see that, and we have documented dominant male cats killing some of the kittens that were born if they weren't dispersed. As far as a large male chasing off a bear, I don't know that our research would really show that. I'm not saying that it couldn't happen, but bears, not many things mess with bears. They're pretty protective of their kill sites, and I would be surprised if they really back off from a cat. A pack of wolves, that's something different. There has been documentation of that, but as far as a cat, I think that they could hold their own, unless it was a really young type bear.
Good follow up,
please.
Do they, when we're talking about territorial and we have elk and deer migrating down into the lower areas, do the cats follow them down as far as during the summer months? Are they up in the high country with game and then they follow the game down in the winter?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, Yes. And what we've really seen is that, you know, it varies by year. Not all animals will migrate a super long ways. So you've got deer and elk that, you know, if it's a real mild winter like we're having this year, they stay up fairly high, and cats will stay with them. We've had cats in 6 feet of snow, but we had elk yarded up in 6 feet of snow. So it really just varies. Obviously, when you get in the west side, you don't see a lot of migration of animals up and down elevation-wise, so you tend to have more resident-type animals. And where you've got a lot of migration going on, what you probably see is home range territories are a lot bigger. And again, where you have those dominant males, you could have some overlap, and they'll do whatever they do with each other.
Okay, thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bottom line here is that irrelevant of the outcome of this particular bill, that we are, in fact, managing cougars. We are, in fact, paying people to do so, and we do, in fact, have an opportunity here to turn it into an income instead of a accounts payable. That's what it amounts to. This organization, ODF&W, our department, is one that's needs help now financially. In fact, they're going to ask for an increase in fees and tags. And I think that this is one of the tools that we can to right this, not only financially, but I'd be curious on how much we spent in the Heppner unit when we had the problem with the calf to cow ratio. I believe we dropped down to less than 15 calves per 100 cows. ODF&W went in and hired a couple of hunters to go in and harvest some cougars, and the very next year the population was back up to 30 calves per 100, which is what the management objective is in the area. But it cost how much? That would be curious.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. So I think I'll let Ron correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're spending somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 a biennium to pay people to use dogs to target certain cougars. I think you teed up the bigger policy question, and others have too, Representative McEwen. And I was testifying on a bill yesterday with relevance to ODF&W's budget, and you're right. The cost issue is one of the big policy questions, I think, that's out there for the legislative body to consider. One way or the other, ODF&W employees are getting calls to deal with a whole lot of things that are not necessarily about either providing fishing or hunting opportunities. It's sometimes about dealing with complaints or conflicts. So cougar calls will come to the agency, and we'll be spending staff time on it one way or the other. It's gets down to the question of who should be paying for that staff time, and are there other approaches. So Ron, I know the representative asked about the Heppner unit.
Yes, Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel. Actually, Appendix 1, which is the last full page in the handout, is a summary of our cougar target areas. The Heppner was a little more than what Brett's saying. That's when we had a bunch of our staff were actually doing the work, and we decided that it was a whole awful lot more efficient to use Wildlife Services because they're trained to do this, and we switched in future target areas to utilizing them or the agents. So, you know, once we've made that switch, Brett's 100% correct. It's been in that 50 to 100,000 a biennium, and that's to run anywhere from 4 to 5 target areas. But initially, the Heppner was pretty expensive, but it was we were using our own staff. And
Ron, you said something that spoke to the concerns of a lot of folks in my district. My district, defined as much by the Coast Mountain Range as it is by the Columbia River, and a fairly healthy number of cats in that area. You mentioned You mentioned preventative maintenance versus waiting until the problem occurs. And I'm assuming that your point was that if those cats, if the population is reduced up front with hunters, that we've diminished the opportunity for some of those cats to become problem cats. Is that the message that you were giving us or not?
Chair Witt, yes. And that's really no different than how we manage deer and elk. We don't manage deer and elk at optimum populations. We manage them at, you know, what will the people in the area tolerate. So we develop management objectives for deer and elk that are based on, you know, habitat, but also landowner and hunter wants and needs. And with cougars, we don't do that. And cougars, even though we might have a desired level we'd like to manage them for, we're not able to get there with the tools that we have unless we're paying people to go out and do that. So with the preventative maintenance, you'd say we want to manage for this level, and you target where you want that management to occur with the hope that you then create spots that, instead of dispersing cats ending up in urban areas, dispersing cats have a hole they can fill out where you'd rather have them on, you know, more open public land or on private timberland in the case of Western Oregon.
Thank you. And so, Brett, you mentioned framing some of the issues, and I'd like to share the issues from many of the people in the district I represent. We would much prefer to avoid the problem altogether. The problem cat means the problem has already occurred. That cat is now down at the local grade school. That cat has pinned horses in several of my neighbors' corrals, has pinned other cats, have pinned other horses in other corrals around the town with considerable frequency. This wasn't happening a couple of decades ago. It happens now, and it's not something that's unusual anymore. And the issue for much of my district is, how do we avoid this becoming the problem in the first place? My constituents would vastly prefer that this not be allowed to become a problem in the first place, that the problem is prevented, as Ron has suggested. Yet there's a dilemma here, Much of the state that feels the same way that my constituents do don't have a chance as long as there is a public policy that is voted on by a public that doesn't face the very problems that are faced on a regular basis by my constituents. So they are a minority that is looking for a solution. They're looking for that middle ground. They have a problem, yet oftentimes feel that they're locked out of any kind of solution that is preventative rather than reactive. I'm looking for a solution. My constituents are looking for a solution. I don't expect that any of you necessarily have an answer to what I've said, but I wanted to frame the issue.
Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Further questions?
Just one quick comment.
Representative Frederick.
Chair Witt, I want to thank you for that for really clarifying what the issue. I agree with you. We need to find a way that we are going to be able to actually be effective across the state and within the communities. And the concerns that I brought up are the ones that I'm hearing on a regular basis. I do not want to hear about a child in Sile suddenly attacked by a cougar as they're walking across the street or walking to their playground because we did not decide to do some preventative effort. And I want to make sure that you have the tools that are effective tools to do that without things being being done that are excessive. And the fear that we have, that I hear about, is the concern about that excess. Because, unfortunately, we have seen that excess in the past. And that is what has fueled the lack of trust for folks. So that you have a quota that you'd like to deal with that would be effectively managed, and that you have a management plan that is sustainable is something I would like to see as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further?
You know, Chair Witt?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Just to go back to Representative Frederick's question about the number of tags, and maybe they can speak to this, but in recent years, there's been a thing called a sportsman's pack, and so you buy a pack and you get all of these tags, turkey and everything else, and so I would assume that has raised the number of tags exponentially, probably.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, yes. There's about 25,000 sport packs that we sell, and every one of those contains a cougar tag and a bear tag. That's been a lot of the increase.
Thank you very much. Panel members, certainly appreciate your appearance today. We appreciate the expert background that you've provided us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Witt.
I'd like to call up next, please, Scott Beckstead. And Scott, you may have a couple of people or several that you want to bring up with you. Welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Kind of feels like deja vu all over again, doesn't it?
It does.
It's like Groundhog Day.
It certainly does.
Groundhog Day.
We've been there, done that.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director and Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I'm pretty sure that those of you who are hearing this again could probably recite my testimony from heart, but I'll see if I can't change it up a little bit for you to keep it interesting. I'd like you to take the handout if you have it yet. On the second page of my materials is ODFW's most recent cougar mortality table. Okay, so this is available on ODFW's website, and it shows the different causes of mortality as well as other figures. And I'd like to direct your attention to the year 2013. Which is the last reported year, and this is what really makes the case for the fact that Measure 18 is working just fine. Cougar complaints are down. 55,072 cougar tags sold. Hunters are having far more success now without dogs than they did when dogs were allowed. And by way of history, let me just interject. By way of history, I was one of the authors of Measure 18. And when we sat down and wrote the measure, we specifically allowed for the use of dogs to control cougar populations or individual cougars that were causing problems. So I think it's important that we reiterate what Measure 18 does and what the voters said when they voted to pass Measure 18 and then 2 years later when they overwhelmingly rejected an attempt to repeal it. The voters of Oregon did not say they don't want cougars hunted. And the voters of Oregon did not say that they don't want dogs used to control problem individual animals. What the voters said is that they don't want dogs to be used for sport. And that is what these bills do. These bills allow the hound hunting of cougars for sport. They allow counties to opt out of Measure 18. The prohibition in Measure 18 on hunting cougars with dogs for sport. Measure 18 is working as these as ODFW's numbers show. The Measure 18 is working by allowing these problem animals to be removed. You know, I live in North Douglas County, and there are a lot of cougars in Douglas County. We have an 1,120-acre horse sanctuary that is home not only to 200 horses, but also to elk and deer and bear and all sorts of animals, and we have never had a single problem with cougars. I agree that science needs to inform the policy here. And you know, Representative Witt, you have done an amazing job on other issues by getting diverse stakeholders to come together and sit down and talk. I, for one, would really like to have a constructive conversation on the issue of poaching, on the issue of ODFW revenue. You know, Chair Witt has fostered an environment where Stan Steele and Scott Beckstead shake hands and sit down and actually have a conversation. Can we do that with this issue and maybe stop this recurring conflict? Can we have a conversation that starts with the science? Can we look and make sure we're using the best science available? I can tell you that my organization stands prepared to engage in that kind of process. Otherwise, if you're going to talk about reversing Measure 18, then the voters deserve to have this put back on the ballot, and let's have the conversation again, and let's let the voters decide, because otherwise you're creating this county-by-county patchwork approach to wildlife management that is going to be an enforcement nightmare. The cougars and the dogs don't know when they're passing over the boundary from a county that allows hounding to a county that doesn't. And it sets a terrible precedent for the democratic process, because suddenly you've got a situation where counties can decide which voter-approved measures they want to follow and which ones they don't. If we're really going to have a conversation about rolling back Measure 18, then let's put it on the ballot and let's let the voters decide again, because they're the ones who made this choice. The person living in Representative Frederick's district has every bit as right to that cougar that's sunning itself right now on the hillsides of Wallowa County as representatives from more rural areas. Wildlife is held in public trust. Belongs to all of us. And all Oregonians should have a right to say what happens to our wildlife. So I'm going to conclude there, but I just want to reiterate, I am more than prepared to have a constructive conversation about cougars, and I think it needs to start with science. We've been asking for a long time for a population model that is sound and that is peer-reviewed. And you know, the population models that we're using now have been roundly criticized by the top cougar biologists in the country, and I think that's a good place for us to start. So that's all I have for now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'd like for your panel to get through before we open it to questions. Scott, I thank you so much for the offer that you just made. And I stated at the outset that I'm looking for people who want to come to the middle. I thank you, sir, so much. Welcome to our committee.
Hi, my name is Angela Norris, and I'm a teacher from Marion County. And I'm here for two reasons. I care about this issue. And the second reason is because I need to read the testimony of Sally Mackler from Predator Defense in opposition to put it onto the record. She has already submitted written testimony, and she'd like me to encourage you to review it before your vote. So,
would it be possible maybe to keep that testimony to hit the high points?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So I'll just go ahead and try to do that really quickly. There's no good reason to overturn ORS 198.64, which was put into state law by Citizen Initiative 20 years ago. The same law was again supported by voters a year later. Please consider the following factual information about cougars in Oregon. Cougar mortality in Oregon is at an all-time high, according to ODFW's most recent records. Well over 500 cats were killed in 2013, as opposed to 208 in 1994, when cougar hounding was prohibited. The number of complaints has currently decreased to levels equal to or less than they were prior to 1994. The number of cougar tags sold has increased 100-fold from 588 to 55,076, generating increased revenue for a budget-strapped department. There's never been a verified attack on a human by a cougar in the history of our state. State law allows liberal damage and public safety killing of cougars posing threats to property or safety. There is no firm data on the state of Oregon's cougar population. The population model used by the ODFW has been roundly criticized by wildlife statisticians and biologists for greatly exaggerating the population size, and a long-awaited revised population model is yet to be put in place or peer-reviewed. Whether you choose to accept ODFW's population estimates or not, there is no justification for undermining Oregonians who twice voted to prohibit a hunting practice they found inappropriate and unethical when used for sport. Please be aware that hounds can and are being used for pursuing and killing cougars for property damage or public safety. And additionally, to overturn state laws sets a dangerous political precedent. State laws are put into place to govern the citizens of the state, not to be cherry-picked by counties. There are likely counties that might decide they want to do away with gun control, marriage rights, and/or driving and drinking age laws, allowing states to be selectively voted on by individual counties would create a patchwork of laws that would significantly challenge efficient and proper law enforcement. I think those were the highlights.
Thank you so very much. That's an excellent job, too. Rhett, good morning. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. Much of what I was going to say this morning has already been stated by the other panelists here. We just hit a couple of highlights. Again, I think we Sierra Club is not convinced that the management tools that are available to ODFW are not sufficient to handle the problems such as they are at this point. As Scott pointed out, the number of complaints is down significantly. Number of cougars being harvested is up. I didn't hear any testimony today from the agency about crashing elk or deer population, so I'm not convinced there's a major issue there, at this point anyway. I think we believe that at this point the measures proposed in these bills are just are not necessary to go beyond what ODFW already has at its disposal. And then to echo the concerns about the subversion of the democratic process, allowing counties to opt out of state laws, I think sets a dangerous precedent. And sets the stage for all kinds of potential mischief on other issues, land use or what have you. And then finally, what Scott said about being willing to sit down and have a conversation about some sort of science-based approach to resolving this issue is something that really resounds with me, and I certainly would speak for the Sierra Club in saying we're also willing to engage in that conversation and would welcome it. So with that, thank you for allowing my testimony, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you for your willingness to approach this from a problem-solving perspective. I so appreciate that. Representative Frederick, did you?
Yes, just one thing. Scott, I appreciate your comments regarding the public right to understand that a cougar is part of the community. I also want you to make sure that you place within that something that really concerns me, because it just does. There's also the right of folks in
in the Coast Range and in other places to be safe. That safety is also important, both in those places. So this is a balance. This is a kind of policy issue that we have to deal with. I want those kids who are walking to school somewhere in Klamath County to not have to be dealing with this as an issue as well. We need to have ODF&W and others able to actually manage well those populations so that we have a preventative aspect. As much as I appreciate the natural common value that takes place regarding predators and other natural environments, we also need to make sure that safety is part of this discussion. So as you have those conversations with whomever you have them with, I really want to make sure that we keep that in mind. Thank you.
Representative Frederick, thank you so much. You framed that so well. Representative Whitsitt,
yeah,
please.
Thank you. Just to follow up on what Representative Frederick said, I can't walk on my property without dogs or being fully armed. We live in a place in Klamath County, a farm, and like Representative Krieger, it is not safe to go. A cougar took a 200-pound calf within 50 feet of our back door and ate it. A cougar chased my dog. I can't let my dogs out unless I'm out with them. A cougar chased a 110-pound German Shepherd right in front of my husband and I across the pasture, only stopped by him running in, getting a gun, which, you know, that's really sad. Yelling, screaming, humans running after it, didn't matter. And so I appreciate that the state of Oregon owns all of the animals. We can't do, and we can't live, we can't go out of our house in some places in this state without being armed. And we have another constituent that had an older dog that a cougar went over a 7-foot fence into this dog's kennel and drug it out in front of her eyes and killed it. And it is not right that we can't live safely. We need to be able to control these animals and enjoy the same rights that people in cities do. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I just briefly address those comments?
Please.
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, and Representative Whitsitt, I appreciate very much the public safety concern, and Measure 18 allows those individual cougars to be controlled with the use of dogs by state agents. The other thing is, the top cougar biologist in the nation, Washington State University, Dr. Wilgus, has stated that hunting pressures, sport hunting pressures, removes the dominant male cougars from the population, and those are the animals that keep the rest of the population stable. So when you take out, in sport hunting situations, those big trophy males, it creates a vacuum, and all the younger cats come in, and the ones who are the losers in those contests are the ones that end up causing a problem.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, maybe you can explain to me what's the difference between having ODF&W harvest 1,000 cougars and having being paid for it. The state of Oregon is a revenue source by other people. The cougar doesn't care. It doesn't matter to the cougar. So why don't you explain to me what's so different about this? And if you say that it's disingenuous or something like that, the one thing that I really bothered me in that 1994 campaign was the Humane Society running an ad with a black panther in a cage that they let out in a, I think it was that or PETA, can't remember which one, they let out in an area that was fenced in. This guy goes and shoots it.
and they explained that it was declawed and defanged. That didn't happen in Oregon. It happened in Texas. But yet that was never announced. So please explain to me what the difference is.
Thank you, Chair Whip, Representative Esquivel. I'm not familiar with that commercial, but I'll tell you, the answer I'm going to give you is not a science-based answer. I'm going to be honest. It's a political answer, and that is the voters of Oregon find the sport hunting of cougars with hounds to be unethical. And because it subjects the entire cougar population to an inhumane practice, as opposed to targeting individual animals that are causing real problems. If dogs are the best way to remove those individual animals that are causing specific problems, that's very different from letting people go out and use dogs because they enjoy it as a pastime.
Before we do, folks, obviously we got very few minutes left. There are some folks that traveled very long distances to get here. I'm going to need to allow them the opportunity to give some very brief testimony because it's going to take them the rest of the day to get back home now. And I don't want folks to travel a 600-700-mile round trip and not get to testify. So I want to let those few people on the witness stand, and we're going to run out of time, and I am going to reconvene. We're going to... We're going to not adjourn. I'm lost for words here.
Recess?
Recess. Thank you very much, Scott. I just couldn't get that word out. We're going to recess here and come back this evening at 5 o'clock. So I don't want folks to necessarily worry that you're not going to get an opportunity to testify today. I'm going to apologize in advance that you're going to have to wait the rest of the day before you get that opportunity. But we're going to hear the testimony, and I'm going to limit people to 3 minutes each. With that, Representative Esquivel, did you have a follow-up?
Go ahead, Mr. Chair. I think we need to expedite people that have.
Thank you very much.
Far.
Representative Barreto. Panel members, thank you very, very much, and thank you for your willingness to try and find middle ground on
thank
this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to call up next, please. Bill Hoyt, I know you're on my list here someplace. And Ty Stubblefield and Sarita Rivera, please. Yes, and folks, if you can keep it to 3 minutes each, you'd really, really help me out here. I've got several people I got to get back home today, and I truly appreciate your making the long trip. Welcome. Bill, it's great to see you.
Thank you, Chair Whit. Chair Whit, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hoyt. I'm a fifth-generation rancher. I'm also represent Oregon Cattlemen's Association, past president and legislative chair. I am speaking to this issue in favor of these two bills. As a rancher in a high-density cougar area, over the last three winters, we have lost more than 60 or 70 head been taken from us. Amounts to a figure roughly in the neighborhood of about $7,000 worth of livestock, calves, goats, sheep, and we use about 300 goats and in our back pastures that are for brush control, blackberry control, and rather than spraying, we use the organic method. And I'll give you a little cowboy anachronism. If you want to know if you have cougars in your area, put some goats out and you'll find out. The cougars are like a lot of predator livestock or predator animals. They are they take the easy route. They like to take whatever is easy. The harder the prey, the less likely they are to take it. So the easy animals are the young, and goats and sheep are easier than cattle. So they will prey on goats first and sheep and then cattle. So if you're in our area where we're in a pretty high density area, one of the reasons that doesn't get brought up a lot of why you want to have this bill, and I really appreciate what Representative McCown had to say earlier about the fact that the people in each county would be able to make these decisions for themselves, and those counties that didn't want to wouldn't necessarily have to do this. But one of the things that is interesting, we use guard dogs, and we have six or eight of them spread around the ranch that are dedicated to certain of our flocks. So we have guard dogs with the goats and guard dogs with the sheep. Two that resident with our goats. One of the things that keeps cougars honest, if you will, is the fact that they are become canine averse when they're chased or hunted by dogs. So that makes my guard dogs much more effective. So that if the cougars are not particularly interested in or harassed by dogs or chased by dogs or hunted by dogs, then they are less likely to be frightened when my guard dogs confront them. So that's one of the things to take into consideration from an empirical standpoint. Our guard dogs are much more effective. We really appreciate the fact. I'm most also willing to enter into discussions with all sides on this issue to try and come up with a solution-based result. That's something that I think the thinking is very appropriate, and thank you for that as well.
Sir, thank you so very, very much. Who's next?
My name's Sarita Rivera. I'm from Douglas County, rancher, you know, outdoorsman.
Welcome.
I enjoy it all. Anyways, we've been hunting the same herds of elk for, my husband and I have been married 32 years, so I'd say 28 years. And what we noticed over the past, say, 6 or 8 years, is there's pretty much no calves in the herds. And so nothing is replacing, so we haven't killed a bull for 3 or 4 years, and you know, my husband's a tracker, so I mean, it's like it's virtually uncommon for us, and that's because, you know, we're stubborn and we like to stay in the same herds, and we hunt in the High Cascades. And then, you know, back to the ranch end of it, recently we had a cougar that happened to all my grandkids' goats, which were in the backside of the ranch, and then of course my goats were down kidding down in the field, so they didn't get killed off. But unfortunately, you know, this cougar managed to kill off, I think it was 17 yearling ewe lambs, that, you know, replacement ewe lambs, which, you know, was cost us a fortune. But, you know, not even taking any of that into consideration, I get angry when I hear people say trophy hunting for cougar. I have bought a cougar tag faithfully for 25 years, and I have never had the opportunity to kill a cougar. And as a child, you know, my dad had hounds, and, you know, we would put one up a tree. I think my dad killed one, maybe one a year, just because he enjoyed the pursuit more than anything. So the trophy hunting thing is, you know, that's silly. And I'm not good at the speaking thing.
You're doing
but,
great.
I have a lot of kids. I have foster kids and kids. And, you know, I fear for their safety. They go out before daylight to do their chores. I had a log truck driver call us and say, I just saw a cougar jump into your field of sheep. And, you know, of course, we freak out because there's kids out feeding their pigs and lambs. And you know, fortunately, we were able to take care of that cougar, because that was the one that was killing the sheep. But, you know, it's really dangerous to bring hounds in to do that where we live, due to where we live on a highway, and there's, you know, we have 400 acres right there that we lease, or 500, but most hound hunters don't want to do it. But I feel if we could control them in the mountains to where they get their fear again, you know, they're not going to come down and prey so much on our kids and our livestock. And then, you know, and unfortunately, the majority of the voters are city, you know, I call them city slickers, but I mean, you know, the majority of the voters are in the cities, and that's unfortunate, because I don't live in the city, and I know I wish my vote counted more, because it's, you know, a real, real important thing to me. And, you know, but that's about all I got to say. I'd turn it over to Ty.
Thank you very much. I welcome.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ty Stubblefield. I'm field administrator for Oregon Hunters Association. I'll try to keep it short. I'm here today to ask for support for these two bills. These two bills are not as much about cougars and dogs or hunters or non-hunters. They're about equality. This is an issue which drastically affects rural Oregon. And rural Oregon is simply asking for the opportunity to vote on an issue on a county-by-county petition. In 94, 36, nine of the 36 counties voted in favor of Measure 18. That means 27 counties were left to deal with these cougars and predators and all. This was damaging to the 27 counties. And the point I think that we're trying to make is that the constituents of Representative Frederick's district that don't hunt don't know anything about cougars and how they relate. They see pictures of them. They see videos of them. They don't have to live with them. Those counties that have to live with them have seen the effects. I keep hearing science. Hunters would want nothing more than for all wildlife to be managed by science. Unfortunately, Measure 18 brought this science-based management to politics. And now politics are managing cougars, not science. We would love to have science back to manage cougars. The economic impact is huge. It's been stated several times today that we're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to manage cats when we could be making hundreds of thousands of dollars more to manage cats. The economics is simple math. A couple of other things that I've heard talked about today are trophy hunts for cougars and orphans. And I just sit there, and the only thing I can figure is that everybody that are making these statements have never hunted with dogs, don't have a clue what it's about. Because a trophy cat, I'd like to see a definition of a trophy cougar. Because for me, I've hunted for 20-some years, any cat, any cougar that I harvest is going to be a trophy. And that can be said for every hunter in the state. And again, science shows, you know, I guess I asked the question, what science shows that dogs are bad? I've never seen a study that shows dogs have a negative impact on cats or deer or elk. In closing, I'd like to point out that this measure or these bills are to reach some common ground between urban and rural counties. This bill doesn't overturn any laws. It doesn't change any laws. It simply gives an opportunity for the counties that are affected the most to make a difference in their counties. Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much.
Record, may I just say one quick
just
thing?
Please, very briefly.
I appreciate your comments, and I want you to try not to assume certain things. One of the things you assumed there was that I had never hunted. That's not true. And I hunted when I was a kid, and I understand a lot of what's going on there. So that's not the case. I just want you to understand that there are other approaches, other people that are involved here, and so the attempt to try to connect with the rest of the state is still there. We have different experiences, and that's the issue that I think we need to deal with. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have two more. Thank you, panel members, very much. Bill, if you'd hang around after the hearing here.
You bet.
I have two more folks. Janine
Duran,
thank you.
There you go. Thank you.
And Jim Ince. Welcome to our committee. Before you begin your testimony, Committee members, I recognize this evening that some of you may have previous commitments. We will be meeting as a subcommittee tonight if necessary. I would love to have as many of you as possible. I recognize it's short notice, and we're going to make this work the best way that we can. So thank you. Welcome to our committee. You have, please, as quickly as you can, a maximum of 3 minutes.
Thank you, Representative Witt. And I am a constituent. I am from the coastal area of Columbia County, and I really appreciate you inviting me to come to this hearing. It's been a real eye-opener for me. I've really appreciated hearing all the testimony and the challenges that rural farmers face. I am a rural farmer myself. I live, I call it the wildlife superhighway. We have horses and chickens, and I have a rescue macaw, and it's really extraordinary. We actually have elk that will come down onto our pasture and spar for fun. So it's been amazing, and I'm an avid outdoors person. I have hiked and horseback ridden and traveled the state. I've hiked thousands of miles, and in all those travails, I have never encountered a cougar. On my farm, we have coyotes that certainly have caused some challenges, and a bald eagle killed a chicken once, but we have never, ever had a cougar come onto our property or have any threat whatsoever, and no Oregonian ever has. We've never had an Oregonian killed by a cougar. And so, you know, the point is that we have Measure 18, which was passed by a majority of Oregonians, including rural people like myself, that realize that we do have to have controls for cougars. And if there are problem cougars, we've got to deal with it. I mean, we cannot have them killing livestock. We cannot have them being a threat to people. And we have those things in place. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has the ability to use dogs. And they're facing some real financial challenges right now because 50% of their revenues come from tags. And the fact of the matter is that 8.9% of Oregonians hunt. So you've got over 90% of Oregonians that don't hunt. And so what needs to happen with Fish and Wildlife is that they need to start taxing us. I am more than willing and happy to pay for the right to enjoy our beautiful state. And I really support this. And I understand both sides. And having been a rural person and having many rural neighbors, I've never had anybody ever state that there's ever been an issue with a cougar attack, ever. And so, and I have a dog. I have a 9-pound rat terrier named Nibbler. And so maybe he's the deterrent. But hopefully, the real truth is that cougars don't like people. And just in closing, as a child, I lived in Africa. So I know a thing or two about predators, lions, cheetahs, leopards, animals that really have killed people. And for millennia, Africans have lived with predators, and as a result, they have an incredibly healthy ecosystem. We need to celebrate predators. We need to have a balance of wildlife in our community, and we also need to have adequate recreation for hunters. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please no applause. Sir, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Thank you for holding this hearing. My name is James Ince, spelled I-N-C-E, and my 160-acre forested ranch surrounded by the Umpqua National Forest is centered in some of Oregon's most prime cougar habitat at the southern end of the Tiller Ranger District.
Can you pull the microphone closer?
Sorry, thank you. I'm at the southern end of the Tiller Ranger District in the Umpqua National Forest, which I'm surrounded by. I partner with my adjacent landowner on another 500 acres in stewarding typically 50 cow-calf pairs. As I've testified numerous times before this committee and others, in the 50-plus years this herd has existed, we have had no instances of predation on any of the cows or calves. Nothing has changed since Measure. I'm going to skip through in the interest of time. I'm going to just hit the high points. Nothing has changed since Measure 18 took effect. The majestic cougar are still in the forest, and they still leave humans, livestock, and domestic animals alone, broadly speaking. The relatively few cases of predation I'm aware of have involved injured or aged cougars, and Measure 18 provides for the use of hounds to deal with such instances. Additionally, juvenile cougar orphaned by harvesting are more prone to become problems, speaking to the poor management tool sport hounding represents. Cougar populations tend to self-regulate by males killing other cougar and other means of population control. The fact is we see no increase in cougar population since Measure 18, demonstrating that it is working as designed and as intended. I personally believe that the repeated assaults on this successful law are frivolous waste of taxpayer money by a very small minority of Oregonians. And credit goes to Oregon and Oregonians for joining the civilized world, including Europe and many of our American states, in banning this barbaric and inhumane sport for once and for all. And I use the term sport very loosely here. Moreover, should individual counties be permitted to circumvent Measure 18's law framework, it would not only set a dangerous and unwanted precedent, but also skew the scientific research on cougar, their habitat, and behavior with which monitoring and other cougar management may credibly take place. Indeed, should any of these bills become law, what would become of Oregon's valued ballot measure initiative process? I urge you to take the best interests of all Oregonians into consideration and deny the repeated and disingenuous machinations of the few. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony very much. Appreciate that. Committee members, audience, we are in recess until 5 p.m. This afternoon. Thank you very much. This afternoon. Thank you very much. The afternoon.